This episode of the Commerce Marketer Podcast is brought to you by the Bronto Marketing Platform, a flexible yet powerful software that helps you grow revenue, save time, and optimize marketing resources. If you're interested in making sophisticated email marketing easy, visit bronto.com. That's B-R-O-N-T-O.com. Things have changed a lot over the past 20 years, from Netscape to Chrome, Blockbuster to Netflix, from me being young to me being old, less young, and e-commerce and retail are no exception. But we get caught up so much in the day-to-day, let's take a step back and talk about some of this. Welcome inside the Commerce Marketer Podcast Studio. I'm your host, Greg Zakowitz. Today, we're going to discuss changes and trends, best practices that might no longer be valid, hear a few stories from the field and lessons learned, and make some predictions about what the e-com landscape will look like in years to come. To do the heavy lifting today, I welcome to the show the CEO of Meva, author of the book Dragonproof E-commerce, and host of the Protecting Your Online Business podcast, Rick Wilson. Welcome to the show, Rick. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Greg, for having me. I'm glad to be here as well.
Hope to have a good conversation with you today. So I know talking offline, you had tons of examples and stories, and we were just kind of riffing about some of this stuff. And we kind of went with the foray of being a little less scripted today. So hopefully that comes across very well for us. Rick, I mentioned last 20 years, which is just kind of an arbitrary number, but you've been in the business for a long time. I mentioned during the intro, you're the CEO of Meva. So real quick, we'll talk about your experience and kind of what you've seen over the past 20 some years of being in the e-com and retail landscape business. But can you give the audience a little background about who Meva is and what your ideal customer looks like when you work with companies?
Sure. So Meva is an e-commerce platform, you know, similar to say Magento Enterprise or Shopify Plus. We're actually older than both of those. We started in the dot-com boom and we've evolved a lot. But our ideal customer is really someone in the mid-market, someone doing $1 million to $100 million in online sales. So established businesses, but generally not Fortune 500 sites. I think we can handle a Fortune 500 site, but that's a different sales cycle, that's just a different beast.
Very cool. And where are you guys based out of?
We are in San Diego. We also have offices in Tampa, but 90% of the staff's in San Diego.
Very good. Is it sunny in San Diego today?
It is gorgeous in San Diego.
Somewhat of a softball there. It's always sunny out there, right?
Yeah. Although, you know, this last winter, which we needed, was the wettest winter. And I've lived in San Diego now for, now I'm going to feel extra old, 24 years. And so we had the wettest winter in my history of San Diego last winter. I felt like I lived in Seattle, but we needed the water. So that was good.
You know, it's funny. I did my internship in Seattle, and this is probably 20 some years ago. And I was out there for about, 2.5-3 months, and it was the summertime, and it happened to be like the warmest and driest summer in like 80 years. And I go out there and it's beautiful every day. And I'm like, what is everyone talking about? It never rains here. It's beautiful, right? Then I've been back a bunch of time in the fall and things like that to visit. And it's, it's rainy and misty and things, but it was a gorgeous summer when I was there.
There is nothing quite as beautiful as a beautiful Seattle summer day. It is it seems like what you hope heaven would look like.
Yeah. I would agree with that. It was a beautiful couple months I was out there, but that's funny. So I mentioned that, and you mentioned as well, I mean, you've been in business for, you've been in the e-com space since the dot-com boom and then bust. So 20 some years, you've witnessed a lot of stuff over that time. If you take a high level view of kind of where we sit now from an e-com and then also from like a consumer standpoint, what's your overall assessment about where we sit now? Are we still in the beginning stages of things? Are we kind of progressing to the middle? And then from a consumer standpoint, do you think we're in a pretty good place as being consumers? Or do you think we're, for whatever reasons, either worse or right where you think we should be?
Well, I think if you just start with where are we in the cycle? If you look at an early adopter, late adopter curve, they kind of have standard deviations of percentages of activity happening somewhere. We're about 13-14% of retail is happening online right now, which puts us still in the early adopter phase. But I would call that the end of the beginning in my mind, and that we're heading as what I think you called it, heading into the middle. That's what it feels like. We're heading into the middle. If you're my age or younger, shopping online is probably a default choice, and you assume that you'll be able to find the product you're looking for online. So yeah, we'll be continuing to head into the middle for a while now. But with that said, because we're still only at 13 or 14% of sales online, there's a lot of headroom ahead for e-commerce, which implies a lot more optimizations to come.
You mentioned there that your age and younger, it's kind of the default option. We talk about it and you can read about it and pretty much everyone's worried about it, but that puts a lot of challenges on retailers, and that could be free shipping, free returns, which eat in the margins and all those things. Where do you think we sit from like a retailer problem perspective right now. So are the free shipping and free returns, are those like the primary problems people are most worried about? Or do you think there's other things on the near-term horizon that retailers should really be looking at when they're selling to consumers? Does that make sense the way I frame that?
I think so. You know, I mean, free shipping and free returns has always struck me as one of those weird straw men boogeymen, because the fact of the matter is, if I go buy something at Target, they shipped it to that Target store. And then if I go walk in and return it, they have to ship it somewhere else. So I think free shipping and free returns has always been, at some level, a business model problem throughout retail. It's just, we've moved where the points are, right? So yeah, you have to account for that in your business model, and there's no getting rid of that. You know, you see sometimes specialty retailers try to charge restocking fees or whatnot for returns, and that pretty much is going to keep you a specialty retailer. You're not going to find a day where someone walks into a Target or a Walmart and pays a percentage to do a return. And so I think that's just something retailers have to put up with as part of their business.
So is there anything that you could see on the near-term horizon that you think is somewhat comparable to that, where it's kind of this headache for the retailer side, but it's something that consumers like or want or are increasingly expecting?
You know, I mean, I think one of the things when it comes to returns, and this is where, you know, a lot of, especially at big retail, most consumers don't realize it. You know, I think consumers think of a return comes into a store. Maybe you imagine retail from the 60s or 70s or early 80s, when the store would look at the return and make sure it was still in sellable new condition, and then they'd go put it back out on the floor. A lot of that's changed. You know, I don't think most consumers realize that stuff doesn't really get handled that way anymore. For the most part, now, I think for small e-commerce shops, it does, right? If it comes back into your own warehouse and you can make sure it's still, you know, you got your right product back and it's in perfect shape, go ahead and resell it, put it back in your inventory. But for a lot of these places, that stuff now gets shipped off to basically be sold in lot. And then it either ends up in an outlet mall or as part of a retail arbitrage sale. So the life cycle of a return could be its own podcast.
So if we look at, I want to say recent trends, but I want to phrase this in a different way, or best practices or accepted practices. So, you know, if you look at back in the dot-com boom and then the dot-com bust, you had the way just kind of the industry was, and you had these best practices or accepted practices. I'm assuming once the bust happened, those things changed pretty drastically. So are there things that even like 3 years ago you could look at that was an accepted practice that is now shifting gears much more quickly than was before? So kind of these evolving best practices, but in a much shorter time frame. Is there anything that jumps off to you right now that it fits that mark?
You know, the one that, it's a little older than 3 years ago, but not much. The one that really struck me on that was the way you could do SEO and SEM marketing back 5 or 6 years ago. And there was a lot of people, Google was very public about how they were going to change their behavior. And they did. They changed their behavior almost to the letter how they said they were going to do it. Now, granted, Google can sometimes speak in vagaries about what their algorithm changes are so people don't game it anymore, or their best to stop gaming it. But a lot of people were doing what they would consider best practices, and Google changed the SEO rules. And I saw businesses go from succeeding wildly to bankrupt. I think a similar thing would be a best practice not that long ago was to really focus on pay-per-click marketing and search engine optimization on Google and totally ignore social. There was this sense that people weren't buying on Facebook. Well, that might have been true 4 years ago. People weren't necessarily buying on Facebook. But people are buying on Instagram like heck right now, and Instagram is part of Facebook. And so the best practices are constantly evolving. And I think that as a merchant, you've got to be looking at how your demographic is shopping, and especially if your demographic leans young.
So you mentioned about a retailer that was doing one thing and then went bankrupt once things changed. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Yeah, you know, and he was a really nice guy. He happened to be a customer of ours. His company was helmetcity.com. I don't think the website exists at all anymore. If it does, it's owned by someone else. But he had been in the motorcycle industry for a long time, like throughout, you know, I think the 80s and 90s, had distribution set up. And he just pretty much ran what you would consider traditional long tail keyword SEO campaigns to stay at the top of Google. I'm not trying to remember what year he launched, but maybe 2000. And I think he finally fell out in about 14. And so he had a pretty decent run of success. But what happened was, between Penguin and Panda, Google stopped really rewarding these small web stores that had a lot of links, and they started rewarding domain authority. So where he would dominate for SEO positions on, say, a name brand helmet for motorcycles, suddenly Amazon won all those spots, and he didn't have enough margin in his business to sell it via Amazon and still survive. And so he went from a many millions of dollars a year helmet distribution business online that had a 10 or 12 year successful run to having to close his doors.
It's a cautious tale, but I look at that and say, I know you mentioned the term gaming the system before, and maybe it was gaming the system, but maybe it was just kind of doing what people said you should be doing at that time is, hey, if you want to improve your SEO here and do this, and then it just comes to kick you in the backside. But there's a lot of retailers or companies that still do things like that now, maybe not that particular thing like link building or whatever, but you still have, whether it's keyword and content and blog posts or whatever, but they're still trying to maximize their search ranking. But like you said, I mean, there could be a simple change here that kind of makes all that null. Where does that put retailers and just companies in general? It could be B2B companies today with trying to balance, hey, we have content here, we have social over here, we have our e-com site that has product descriptions here, which I don't know, maybe we have more reviews and things like that we're trying to plug in. So they're always trying to get the advantage there. What do you think that means for retailers nowadays? Is there a cautionary tale that people should be looking at now, even though from a lesson learned way back then?
Yeah, there probably is. And you know, as you were talking, it made me laugh because Google explicitly states, don't try to do anything to get better rankings, which is sort of a silly, which is sort of a silly statement, right? It's kind of a Zen.
Absolutely.
Succeed, but don't focus on the success. So, you know, what I think Google means by that, if I can interpret the Google Oracle, no pun intended, is what they want you to do is deliver high quality content that is usable for the people looking at it. And Google has, while I don't know anything about what's in their actual algorithm, you know, that appears to be what they constantly optimize toward. They constantly optimize toward websites that are providing the information that the customer is looking for. And so could that change in the future? Will it change? Yeah, certainly. You know, what happens when we go, you know, to think about the mobile revolution, right? So for a long time, and this goes back to the best practices question earlier, for a long time, people would say, oh, no one's going to shop on mobile. And then next thing you know, it was about a 6 to 12 month window where if you didn't have your mobile site up and running and optimized, you went from winning to losing. And it's hard to predict what that's going to be. You know, is it going to be voice? Maybe for some things, you know, for reordering commodity products in your house, it's hard to imagine doing product discovery via voice. Is it going to be AR? You know, maybe it's that. That's the thing is, as the mediums change, the rules change. And so you've always got to be on the lookout for a medium change. So what I mean by that is the medium went from desktops with big monitors and keyboards to mobile with small screens and touch screens. That was a medium change, and you need to be aware of that change. On the advertising side, I would say a medium change went from search engines to social. And when those changes are happening and you see them happening, you need to start questioning your assumptions and questioning best practices, because they may go from best to worst practices really fast.
You mentioned best practices in there, and I'm going to circle back to kind of a medium change in a few minutes here. But when we talk about email marketing, when I was doing email consulting here at Bronto, you know, you try to put together best practices because they're quote unquote best, right? But another term is kind of looking at like the safe choice. It's what we know kind of works across the board, and then we try to optimize it from there for our unique situation. But I'm this proponent of, unless you're pushing best practices, you're never going to get those upper tier results, because you're just kind of ho-humming along, right? You're just kind of maintaining as opposed to optimizing.
Yep.
The same thing can hold true for a retailer just outside of email. And that could be, like you mentioned, it could be, okay, where everyone's on laptops and they have these big, or desktops, and they have these big screens here, and that's a safe choice there. So are there instances you can think of where there are current best practices that maybe retailers should be looking at either optimizing or just pushing boundaries of, being like, you know what, that's a best practice, but I don't think that's the right way to do that. Can you think of an instance of either a company kind of trying to stay quote unquote safe and being impacted by it? Or can you think of one of those instances now where you're looking at a traditional best practice saying, this is probably going to change in the next 2 years, and people kind of need to look at this and figure out how to optimize it now?
You know, I don't know if I have anything tactical on that level, like other than there is going to be a continuing push. TikTok, for example, and I am going back to how old we are at this point. I'm a little too old for the TikTok generation. But
so I was just going to ask if you use TikTok.
I've only seen it a couple times, but I've not used it. But I get it. I mean, it's Vine 2.0, and I appreciated Vine. I appreciate it, I guess, is what I'd say. TikTok will have an impact on sales and marketing, and someone needs to be looking at it now. But you know, talking about the safe choice idea there, that made me think of something else, which is, you know, think about Gillette, which paid $1 billion for Dollar Shave Club. Now, Gillette was absolutely making the safe choice before Dollar Shave Club came out. There is no chance on this earth that Gillette would have ran the ads the Dollar Shave Club ran when it popped, because they were too edgy, right? I mean, they were really edgy. They were viral. They were funny. They pushed the bounds of decency at the time. That line changes. And because of that, they ended up having to spend $1 billion to neutralize that enemy short 3 or 4 years later. So I think that's a place where a safe choice versus a best practice or aggressive choice turned out in favor of the person constantly optimizing for new media and new situations.
That's a really good example. We were talking about shaving before we got online today, right? So this is kind of a good thing here. You know, there's no way they would have ever, at least in my opinion, ever launched a Dollar Shave Club type product, right? And I mean, you can call them whatever you want, disruptors or whatever it is, but there's no way they're launching that product. And then, like you said, they're paying $1 billion to neutralize it. So, you know, I don't know really how to ask you this, Rick, but is there any sort of lesson there that a retailer can take?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two different lessons you can take on it. It depends on what you are. So if you're the upstart retailer should ask themselves, what could I do that's interesting that would be profitable for me, that would be a great customer experience, that has the opportunity to get noticed, that my competitor would never, ever, ever do, right? So let's say you're a shoe company, you're an upstart shoe company. It's pretty easy to imagine what Nike's boundaries are for what they wouldn't do marketing wise. And Nike sometimes pushes those boundaries pretty hard. You know, you're not going to go hire, I'm horrible with names, Colin
Kaepernick.
Yeah, you're not going to go hire Kaepernick to do that ad if you're an upstart retailer. But there's other things you could figure out to do that Nike would never touch. So that's one way to look at it. And that could also be with, you know, product design. The other side of that, though, and I think this has always been studied with Apple, you need to look at disrupting yourself, right? So if you have a cash cow product, how do you change that cash cow product so that someone else doesn't come and disrupt you from underneath? And I think Microsoft is a great example of this. You know, Office and Windows, you know, for years were sort of taxes you paid to use computers. And they were able under, you know, in the current CEO's situation, he was able to rebuild that whole company around the cloud, turn Office and Windows into subscription products. He essentially converted a cash cow installed base software to a SaaS company while building a cloud company underneath it, and really unlocked a new future for Microsoft. And so he disrupted himself versus waiting for something like Google Docs to come along and just slowly kill Microsoft Office's licensing model.
Do you think that's where the general blind spot for retailers today is? Just kind of not looking at their own business and figuring out how it can be disrupted by someone else? Or do you think it's a bad term, but complacency from a retailer standpoint? Hey, we're doing great here. Let's just kind of run with it and worry about different things of the business. Do you think it's more complacency, or do you think it's an actual blind spot? You know, success breeds content.
I think it's maybe both. I know just from running Meva that, in fact, I have an offsite on Monday. My COO and I, probably once a quarter at this point, set offsites to go have these kind of conversations. Because the fact of the matter is, if I thought I'm going to take the time to do it here at the office, it's not going to happen. I roll in between the front door of our building and my office. I got people asking me questions. Even just now, when I ran to the restroom before this podcast, someone was asking me something. I'm like, oh, I got to go back in. I'm recording a podcast for the hour. And I realized I better lock my door so no one interrupts us. So what I think for most retailers is they're just busy surviving the day-to-day of their business. And then you throw in family and personal issues and all the other stuff. So it's really about building a system to take the time to figure out how to disrupt yourself and ask yourself those hard questions. Hey, what is it? What's my cash cow right now that's at risk? What can I build that's a new cash cow? You know, you need to just get out and it's cliche, but it's the time working on your business as opposed to in your business. And if you don't do that time, you will get disrupted. You know, I know Steve Jobs is notorious. I think they still do a version of this, and it's grown to thousands of employees. But he used to take his top 100 employees to a retreat for 5 days. And essentially, they would just brainstorm how to disrupt Apple from the ground up. And then that became a lot of their new product lines.
You said you're going offsite on Monday. Have you guys done that before?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We do offsites. I'd say we try to do them quarterly. We probably get 3 of them a year out.
Okay. That's probably fair. How valuable? I'm assuming they're valuable because you still do them, but how many tangible takeaways do you guys normally get out of those things that actually get implemented that you look at and say, you know, man, if we never, if you sit back and take a you know, the hindsight view of it, say, man, if we never did that, we'd really be in trouble. And it doesn't mean you're bankrupt or anything, but you know, you just kind of see the progression there. How valuable have those things been for you?
For us, they've been extremely valuable. And I'll say this, I think the secret to that, and this is just one of those random things that I got lucky as a young person growing up in California, I went through some student leadership training that taught us about setting agendas and facilitating meetings. And it was one of those random things I learned back in the 80s that turned out to be maybe the most valuable skill I ever got. If you have one of those offsite meetings and you don't have a purpose, right, you don't have a list of an agenda to brainstorm through, and I don't mean Robert's Rules of Orders, I just mean a whiteboard on the wall with four or five bullet points on it. And you have to have the discipline to stay on subject, right? But to the extent that you can do those two things and have a purpose for that meeting, those meetings for us have been absolutely critical. I can think of one we did a little over a year ago here at Meva. We have an internal professional services department. So primarily we're a SaaS company and people, you know, use our software however they want. But we do have a team of people who help build websites or maintain websites when necessary. And that team had sort of, for lack of a better term, meandered into feature creep as a team, right? We had too many customers, not enough purpose for those customers, and it was impossible to manage the team. We suddenly had more employees doing less work, and yeah, it wasn't going to make us go bankrupt. It wasn't going to kill the business, but we had to figure out what on earth we were going to do with that team. And so we went off site, and the specific agenda item was, if we didn't have any clients or any work, we had these same 50 people who were really great, how would we rebuild them from scratch to be more effective? And we came up with a new vision for that team. And then we spent the last year sort of tacking that boat over to the new vision.
That's a cool example. I'm going to dig into this just a little bit, and you can stop me if I'm going too far, sure, by all means. And I can always edit out later too, so no one will know. So is this all upper management that goes out? Do you ever invite less senior people out to the to get different perspectives as well, or is it simply just upper management?
So we do actually have a variety of those things. So the quarterly stuff that we really do three times a year, that's upper management. It's almost always our COO, myself, and our VP of product. Those are kind of the standard trio. And then we invite people along depending on the purpose. So for example, in the professional services case, our VP of professional services, you know, was obviously part of that conversation. Our VP of, or senior VP of sales and marketing was part of that conversation because it was going to impact how we focused sales and marketing. And then at least once a year, we try to do another one that I wasn't really even counting as part of these offsites. And this one, I don't know, this one, I have, my opinion on the efficacy is a little different. We do what we call a leader's day, where we take like a second round, about 40 or 50 people offsite for a day. And we give them a chance to do brainstorming and similar exercises, but they also get a chance to hear from upper management. And I think it's been really helpful because the feedback we get from them is great, but it's harder for me because I'm more kind of in the weeds on that than to tell how effective it's been on the business.
That's fair. Very cool. I appreciate you sharing some insight into that. So I,
oh yeah, happy to, you know, and obviously there's nothing secret in that. I mean, that's the kind of stuff I could geek out and talk about all day.
So you mentioned that you took some courses that kind of, I think it was a course you said back then that kind of help you with setting agendas or whatever. Is there one particular rule you have with meetings? Like you always hear about like the stand-up meetings and you have this meeting. Outside of the agenda, is there something that you find more productive than others when it comes to meetings?
Well, especially for these kind of ad hoc meetings, yeah. Because I mean, you know, we have a, and I'm sure most anyone here has some, you know, Elon Musk talks about have no such thing as a regular meeting schedule. I mean, maybe if you're Elon Musk, but I haven't been able to figure that out. Every Friday morning, I've got a manager's meeting that's kind of a mid-level manager's meeting that I facilitate. And then right after that, we have an all-company stand-up huddle that's 10 minutes where I give updates to the whole company. And I don't really see how to, I mean, I could digitize those. I could put them in Slack. But, you know, those things I feel like give a belly-to-belly warmness of meeting with the staff that's really helpful. When it comes to the offsite ad hoc meetings where, hey, we want to go brainstorm product scalability for the next 5 years, or we want to go brainstorm how to rebuild professional services, or we want to go, or if you're a retailer listening to this podcast, you know, what's a new product line we could do to, that's a natural extension of our product line. If you've got a purpose for the meeting, I think the agenda is the most important part. What is the purpose of the meeting? And then assigning a facilitator to the meeting, probably not the CEO of the company, assigning a facilitator to the meeting whose job it is to keep focused on that question so you don't kind of meander into nowhere land. And then most importantly is as you're brainstorming, you write down all the ideas, keep people from dissing on each other's ideas. So you get stuff written down properly. That's just, you know, it's just a laundry list of ideas, and then turn it into some sort of next steps at the end. Cause otherwise, if all you do is brainstorm lists and you don't do next steps out of it, nothing happens.
Sure. I want to circle back to kind of the .com stuff, if we can. So we were going through and, you know, just kind of, again, we're talking about 20 years here. So if you look back at 20 years ago, e-com, and fast forward to today, are there any of those best practices that are still present today that you kind of look at and you're like, I can't believe that thing is still around, but we're still doing that?
I hadn't thought about that. You know,
so I had someone on the podcast, I don't know, probably 2 years ago, and she says, I can't believe hashtags are a thing, right? This is one of those things. She's like, we're communicating by, we're grouping things by hashtags, you know? And it just, to her, she just hated hashtags, right? But she's like, it seems so archaic to do something like this. But I mean, it works, right?
Yeah, and it's funny. I think about what best practices were 20 years ago. You know, you had sort of a hierarchy for how to organize your site. It was designed to run on desktop screen. You had categories on the left. You had sort of a header. You had like the C frame, right? So you had a header and a footer. And on the left side, you had a category tree of categories people could click through. And then you had this sort of middle content area. And a lot of your focus back then on best practices was trust, right? Because was your credit card going to get stolen? Was the product going to get delivered? So there was companies like BuySafe who guaranteed your product would show up. And there was HackerSafe that guaranteed you weren't going to get your credit card stolen. And you don't really see many of those kind of things these days. People, and I think we can thank Amazon for this, people have really come to a world where they trust that when they – well, two things. They trust that when they order something online, they're going to get it for the most part. And I think they also know that if they put their credit card in online and it gets stolen, they're probably not at risk for much. So I don't know if a lot of those best practices, or if any of those old school best practices that I can think of, you know, having stuff above the fold, quote unquote, you know, those things, the whole world changed. It all changed when the screen size changed.
Yeah. Are there any best practices today that you could think of that you wish would just jump off a bridge?
There's definitely a type of best practice today that you see when it comes to checkout funnels that drives me personally nuts. And I think it's tied to this age of Instagram marketing that's kind of impulse. So let's say you're on Instagram and you get targeted an ad for a pair of shorts you're interested in. So you click through that pair of shorts and you see they've got your size and it's free shipping and you'll have it tomorrow or whatever. And you can use Apple Pay. So you're ready to check out. But you may want, at least for me, you know, I tend to want to look at other stuff. If there's a brand that's got clothes that fit me well, I probably am going to order more than one item. And best practices today are to sort of cattle shoot you through checkout. And I hate that one personally. That could just be me, though. I have no idea if there's any data. I assume a lot of the checkout optimization is focused on better to get people through the sale and close them and then use email marketing after the fact to get them to come back.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because I think for me it's a mixed bag. But you're right. If I'm seeing an ad on Instagram, a lot of times it's from a retailer that I'm either less familiar with, or I just haven't, maybe not familiar with at all, or I just haven't really shopped much or at all with them, but I'm familiar with them. And if I'm to the point where I do want to buy, I'm like you, like, oh, that's a nice pair of shorts. I need a new pair of shorts. What else do they have? Maybe there's a shirt that I want or a second pair of shorts or a different style. So I'm with you on that front because, you know, if I'm an active shopper at, I don't know, Gap, chances are they're not hitting me up with an ad on Instagram, you know, because they know I'm an active shopper there. So it's going to be a different company there. So I'm with you on that one. I would much rather bounce around and be able to check out a couple different products and then make a singular order as well. So it's a good example. You mentioned Amazon. So I'm going to pivot into, you recently wrote a book called Dragonproof E-commerce, dragonproofbook.com, by the way. Really, the book speaks to the hysteria surrounding the rise of Amazon, quote unquote, dragon. It makes the argument for viewing the e-commerce giant as a catalyst for positive change. I hope I summarized that well enough. Can you explain, Rick, what you mean by using Amazon as a catalyst for positive change?
Sure. I mean, I think I would step back and explain why I referred to it as dragon proof as opposed to Amazon proof. The first premise of the book was, and I was talking to my internal staff here and how this book evolved over the last, because it's been out now for, I finished writing it about a year ago and it's been out since February. And so you start forgetting how you got here. And what was happening is our internal marketing team kept talking about slaying the dragon, and they were trying to sell to merchants that they're going to slay the dragon. And they were referring to Amazon as the dragon. And I would be with my marketing team and I would start riffing. I'd be like, you guys are, you're crazy if you think one of our clients is going to slay Amazon. That's not how this works. You know, I said, Jeff Bezos is literally the wealthiest man in the world. They're a $1 trillion company. I am proud of our clients all day and night. In fact, I love the entrepreneurial story of our client base, but I don't really see one of them becoming the next Amazon.com. I think the secret is they have to dragon-proof their business, not slay the dragon. And as that riffing happened, what we talked about was there's always a dragon. Before Amazon, it was Walmart, right? So you had Walmart. It wasn't that long ago that people were protesting Walmart in the streets because they were, quote unquote, ruining America. And before that, it was Sears, right? And one of the things that during my research for the book, 100 years ago, Sears had a larger percentage of retail versus GDP in America than Amazon does today. So it made me realize not only is there always a dragon, there have been bigger dragons. And history suggests, not counting pain that you go through during the process, not counting disruption you go through in the process, history suggests that things like Amazon as a dragon or Walmart as a previous dragon or and Contender as current dragon and Sears, those things cause retail and entrepreneurism to grow. There is more business happening today. There are more ideas happening today, specifically because of the fact that these ecosystems got built. And one example on Amazon being positive change, if you get a brand now and you get any brand traction, and if you have enough margin, you can stick your product on Amazon and get and probably double your sales, right? Amazon's representing half of e-commerce. So you have a way, Amazon will hand you customers. Granted, they take a pretty penny for it, but they will hand you customers. And as long as you build your business around that, that's a positive change.
So it's funny you say that because when I was doing consulting, I used to have people that would say something like, well, Amazon does it or Walmart does it. And I always wanted to sit there and say, well, you're not Walmart.
You
know? Yeah. It's like your point, no offense. I love you. But you're not Walmart, right? You have to do things a little bit differently. So I appreciate you saying that. You mentioned there was Walmart before, which is still a powerhouse in the industry. There was Sears before, which certainly we could say, for lack of better terms, less of a powerhouse in the industry now. I know when I always go to visit my wife's uncle up in Virginia, Gary, shout out Gary. So we always get on this conversation about Amazon and Sears, and we always banter back and forth. And it's like, well, what's going to happen with Amazon 20 years and 30 years from now? And we talk about these things. Do you think it's a smart move for Amazon to kind of diversify itself? I'm assuming it's going to be a smart thing for them, but do you think it's a necessary thing? I think is a better question.
You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about a few different things that popped to mind out of that conversation. One thing about, and this is just a quick riff on the concept of dragons. And I haven't done this studying, but I was talking to someone about this recently, and they suggested that dragons as companies tend to have the height of their reign while the founders of the companies are at the helm. And so, who knows how long Jeff Bezos will run Amazon, but I would say for the next 20 years, you're going to have Jeff Bezos' Amazon. And then after that, Amazon will turn into any other conglomerate. As far as its diversification, Amazon is kind of moat upon moat upon moat. You know, it's like using the dragon analogy. They built a moat with Prime, and then they built a moat with AWS, and then they built a moat with their payment infrastructure, and they're doing now one with their ad business. And so do I think it's a smart move on their part? Yeah, of course. I think Jeff Bezos has an instinctual, and it looks like, I can't imagine he's quarterbacking everything with an Amazon. So it looks like he's built a culture of people who understand the idea of defensible positions and strategy. And so I think that's great for them. But there's also a thing about scale. You get to scale as their ad business grows, their customer experience may suffer on the retail side. Think about it like the iPod. If you loved Apple because of the iPod, you probably don't love Apple as much today because they killed the iPod. Well, you can imagine a world where AWS and their ad business are so big that they just stop caring strategically about their retail experience.
How do you think they're going to change if you look at, if you just had to make a prediction, say, okay, 5 years might be too soon, but maybe 10 to 20 years out, and you look at Amazon today, where do you think that if you had to guess where the biggest change with them is going to be, what would you think that is?
That's a good question. I'm always hesitant to predict that stuff because it's so hard to see. But I mean,
No one will go back 20 years from now and be like, that guy. Podcast will be done by then.
Yeah. I think what you're going to see is, I think Amazon's business kind of comes into some buckets, right? So as opposed to thinking of them as a retailer or a marketplace, they're really a customer acquisition hub. And that customer acquisition hub can be served via the marketplace where you pay a percentage for that, or it can be served via their ad business. And they're going to continue refining things like Alexa and Fire. And those things are going to continue to be client acquisition drivers. And so, and I don't think their business in that sense is all that different than Facebook and Instagram's or Google's or eBay's. You can charge a specific take rate for delivering a new customer. And that take rate generally is between 15 and 30%. And so I think you're going to see just more and more of that because they can keep leveraging their scale to do that. And they'll find new ways for product discovery. And it may be very, very different than going to Amazon.com and looking at stuff. It could be, you know, all sorts of microsites or subsites that the only way you know it's Amazon is because it's got the Amazon checkout flow. But I do think their ad business is going to continue to rise. I think their Prime business, I mean, Prime, their logistics business, you know, I think will be a full-fledged UPS, FedEx competitor. I mean, it's practically that today. And I think their, you know, their entertainment side of their business, which is, you know, something that's I have the least understanding about, you know, that's what's so weird about them is that they're a Netflix competitor and an Apple competitor, and a competitor to my clients and a competitor to your clients and a competitor to Microsoft. They're a fascinating multi-headed beast.
I got a text while we were talking here that my Prime Now food order has been delivered, grocery order delivered.
Yeah, exactly. We're a Grubhub competitor.
So if one of your retailers comes to you, Rick, and says, what's the most important thing I could do to compete with Amazon? And that could be just from keeping customers loyal, attracting customers, doing something to not beat Amazon completely, but just to compete with them a little bit more. What would that one piece of advice you would give to a retailer be?
Sure. The first thing I always say is make sure you have a product that has sufficient intellectual property such that you can maintain high enough margins that you could sell it on Amazon for a profit. And I would include sell it on eBay for a profit, sell it via Instagram for a profit. You need to be able to use these client acquisition channels and still make a profit. It doesn't have to be a huge profit. And then you absolutely have to find a way to convert those customers who buy from you into joining your Facebook page or getting on your email list or coming to your website, and you need to turn them into repeat buyers. If you can do that, you have now your own moat, right? So I can think of, I just ordered some vitamins from Amazon this week, and I'm always fascinated to see because you're not allowed to include, you know, come to my website and I'll give you this off kind of thing in the Amazon stuff. They'll bite you for that. But you can certainly include a warranty card and maybe a Facebook page shout out for, you know, best health tips for my vitamins. And so there was an interesting card in my vitamins I got yesterday that was probably right on the edge of Amazon's terms of service, but it was very well designed to get me to join their community. And once I'm in their community, then they can leverage me for higher margin orders, repeat orders. You know, the thing a merchant has control over is they have control over the order value, right? So how much, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier with best practices, I think merchants should focus on getting multiple things in an order and increasing their average order value, getting repeat customers, and then ease of checkout. Well, Amazon's got ease of checkout pretty nailed, but Amazon doesn't give the merchant a lot of tools for those other two things, which is why you have to build a direct relationship with your clients. If you can't build a direct relationship with your clients, or if there's nothing special about your product, if you're just private labeling something from Alibaba, you probably have pain in your future.
So if we talk about competing with Amazon and we talk about these trends that are coming up and things you can do here, if you mentioned before kind of one of these medium-sized changes that really impacted the industry. If you sit here today and say, okay, what's the next medium-sized change that's going to come in the next couple of years that either you predict it's going to be or just something that's you have your eye on, what would you say that medium-sized change would be?
You know, one of the ones that's out there that's coming, and it's a question of timing. Timing is always such a critical part of any of these stories. When it comes to bigger sales, you know, think home furnishings or even clothes, AR is going to make a difference. There's going to be a point here soon where either they'll figure out putting glasses on people's heads or people using your phone for it, but you'll soon be able to look at yourself in clothes or properly look at furniture in your house. And maybe even if you get all the way into VR, have an experience of sitting on that furniture, although that's probably more ways off, that's going to change and allow for a new category of retail to really take off. That one's out there. I think when it comes to commodity transactions or subscription transactions, I think voice, right? So if I need toilet paper now, I can ask Alexa for toilet paper and it's going to know what kind of toilet paper I want. And that's a lot easier than in the old days when I had to go get in a car and drive to Vons to buy it.
That's interesting that you say that because obviously Alibaba did a couple of years ago for, I think it might have been for Singles Day, but they had, you could virtually walk through a storefront, right? And I think it was maybe Macy's in New York City that I think they did it for. But just yesterday, I saw a post about Ulta having a VR shopping experience now where you can go and just kind of, so if you want to go to, say, the New York store at XYZ address in Ulta, you could actually go online and do a 3D and kind of walk through the different things of the store. You can't purchase the items there yet, but it's the exact same layout in the store. So you can see exactly what you're looking for, where it's placed in the store. And I think this is kind of the tipping point for VR and things like that, where you're going to start having those physical storefronts that become digital where you can shop. And Ulta does have virtual shopping that'll link you back to the store to place products. But I think it's interesting timing that you said the VR and the AR type stuff in there, because you're starting to see more retailers now play with it and figure out, hey, what's the best use case for this? But I don't think anyone's really, we're not there yet, right? But people are starting to dabble with it in a bunch of different areas now, which I find really interesting.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and it's funny, I didn't see the Ulta thing, but if you think about it now, it's been a couple of years since I've done this, but that was probably a 10-year string where I would go to New York City over Thanksgiving or Christmas every year. And I never actually did much shopping in New York City because I'm not a, you know, high fashion shopper, but I certainly would walk and look at all the storefronts and product discovery via storefront window. You know, it's the what's old is new again. Product discovery via high-end storefront window on Fifth Avenue is going to be still some of the highest quality, best product discovery in shopping and retail anywhere there is today. And that will someday translate online via AR, which is where you're heading with that story. And I think once that gets cracked, you will see a new revolution in product discovery, which is arguably one of Amazon's weak spots today. Product discovery on Amazon stinks.
Yeah, because it's all based on ads there, right? So you're just getting served up similar products, right? You're going to, for the most part, you're going to Amazon to buy something very specific or to look for something very specific versus, well, one of the new items they have.
Yeah, absolutely. You either go to Amazon because you know exactly what you want, or you're going to reorder something. And I always joke with people that Amazon's product discovery is to promote you an Alexa or the thing you bought yesterday.
That is true. What's your take on, we keep seeing this rise of headless commerce. What's your take on headless commerce? Do you think this is a passing fad? Do you think it's just a different way to do things that some people will gravitate to, some won't? Or do you think it's maybe more for the big guys? What's your take on where we're at now with headless commerce?
You know, I don't think it's a passing fad. I think if you think about what headless commerce means, I think it's a passing phrase, not a passing fad.
Okay.
The term really means API-driven technology, right? That's all it means at the end of the day, right? So, and sure, in first and second generation e-commerce platforms, were those APIs not exposed in a way that you could leverage them externally? That's true. So the new trend is making sure that everything has a documented API so that I can build to it and use it the way I want. But I do think that's going to be more for the medium size and bigger guys. You know, even if you're doing $1 million a year in sales, screwing around with headless commerce is probably a waste of time, because why do you need to build your own UI and functionality sets off of APIs versus just using one of the well-built platforms that's out there? Now, if you're Macy's, where you have a team, you know, probably of 100 web developers maintaining all of your content pages, then sure, I think in places like that, pure headless commerce is going to be there to stay, because really, not that different than using, say, Stripe for payments. You want to be able to hit an API and then get an expected outcome. But that's really, if you understand the technology behind e-commerce, that's how it's always worked. Just for a long time, the APIs were private as opposed to public.
Very cool. I know it pops up every day, right, in news feeds and things like that. Now, I'll probably do a podcast on headless commerce as well, but you know, I'm curious about it a little bit. So
I will say this. I mean, this podcast is for retailers, not e-commerce platforms. But if you're a legacy e-commerce platform and you don't have any APIs whatsoever, you know, if you can't fix that really fast and expose your APIs to your customer base, as they have to replatform, that's going to be a competitive choice for them.
It's good to know. I appreciate you saying that too. That's cool. So Rick, last 20 years, what is the one time that has been the most interesting? And maybe not you personally, but if you look at the evolution of whether it's new technology, whether it's smartphones, whether it's, we're at 5G now, but whether it was like 3G coming or 4G, you know, if you look back at something in the last 20 years from the e-com standpoint, what would you point to as being the most interesting development over the last 20 years?
You know, it's funny, this will tie back to something you asked earlier that I didn't even think about. So you talked about disruptions that are coming, and I know this is cliche in some circles. 5G is likely a disruption that's coming. Predicting what that disruption is, I think, harder to do at this point than anything, because most people don't have any practical understanding of 5G rollout. But my answer would be the most interesting transition I've seen in e-commerce was it wasn't just smartphones, because smartphones themselves didn't really enable a high-quality commerce experience. It was a trio of things coming together. It was smartphones. It was probably specifically that Android and iOS split the smartphone market, so you had a very consistent user experience. Screen size is pretty much homogenized, so you know it's going to be between 4.7 and 6.2 inches or whatever. And you had LTE, right? Now you had enough bandwidth to make it work. Even 3G wasn't enough to make shopping functional. And then last but not least, you had the payments piece come together. You had Apple Pay and PayPal and Android Pay. And those things solved and Amazon Pay. Those things all solved the me having to type my address on a tiny screen problem. And when those three things came together, what we saw here internally was we saw mobile shopping go. You'd see people at a nice mobile optimized site, and maybe they'd be getting 10% of their business that way. And once, as the conversion of those three things came together, we routinely saw it, especially for B2C brands, jump to 50%.
I assume it's going to go up even more. Just we're trending that way. It's been trending that way every single year. So I don't want to say, do you think it's going to, you know, more mobile sales will happen and replace laptop with it. But do you think 5G is going to accelerate that? Or do you think it's just going to be a nicer to have as far as shopping goes on the 5G front?
I suspect 5G is probably what's going to accelerate the AR, VR stuff. So
that's probably right.
You know, because 5G, and it's also going to allow other business to business, we're probably starting to run out of time here, but business to business commerce is also a whole other subject you could spend another hour on. You're really going to have the ability with 5G to, you know, it's no different than what I could do at my office. And even this morning, thinking about where I wanted to be for the podcast, in a 5G world, I could do this podcast from Starbucks, technically, or from WeWork, or from the park, because I know I would have enough bandwidth to do it and not worry about the quality. But I'm still in a world where I wanted to be on a hardwired high-speed network, and so I came to the office. And those are kind of the subtle changes that 5G is going to bring that's going to take a little sleuthing to uncover how that's going to change retail.
Excellent. Great insights. So, Rick, I know we're just kind of riffing about stuff today, but anything I neglected to ask you that you feel is kind of pertinent for the conversation?
No, I think I covered this, but I will reiterate, you know, the one thing that I kind of harp on the most is I'm not anti-Amazon, and I'm not really particularly pro-Amazon as a merchant. As a consumer, I'm pro-Amazon in that I buy stuff from them all the time. But I think scale has its limits. It's kind of like trying to reach the speed of light. My gut feeling is that Amazon will continue to control about half of e-commerce, and that'll continue to grow because e-commerce is growing. But that still means the other half is all opportunity. And so I think those out there listening to this podcast, if you're selling on the internet, if you're a retailer today, selling on the internet or not, it's kind of irrelevant. Find a way to leverage Amazon to grow your business. If you don't have the right yield of Amazon business, then if you either have too much yield of Amazon business, if 100% of your business is on Amazon, you're at risk. And if 0% of your business is on Amazon, you're throwing business away. And so I think you need to use Amazon as sort of an index for what percentage should be going through Amazon. And if you can make sure you're making a profit on Amazon, then I think you've got a pretty bulletproof business or dragonproof business.
Awesome. Very good way to cap that up there, Rick. You got a couple minutes to answer a couple questions for me before we close out here?
Sure, of course.
Cool. What's the one piece of advice you give to your younger self?
That's a good question. I think the one piece of advice I would give to my younger self is the same piece of advice I gave to us earlier about going off site. You know, in your own personal life, you got to go off site and work on yourself. It's so easy to get complacent with just trying to get up and take care of the dogs or the kids and keep the house clean and go to work and do all your family obligations and everything else. But if you don't take time to work on yourself, you will get stuck just like businesses get stuck.
Great advice. Great advice. I love it. Are you a Prime member?
I am a Prime member. Yeah.
Are you a Inbox Zero person?
I'm more like an Inbox 20 person, but I keep my inbox usually between 10 and 20 items. I kind of treat it as a to-do list. But I'm not obsessive about getting to zero. I tend to go to Burning Man, so I always try to get to zero right before I leave. But when I come back, it's at 1,000, so that's kind of a outlier.
Awesome. Awesome. Do you say niche or niche?
I say niche.
All right. Is wind chill and heat index a thing, or are those temperatures the temperature?
Oh God. I don't know if I have an opinion on that. They feel like the thing. That's my opinion.
All right. What's your favorite restaurant where you live? So you're down San Diego, right?
Yeah. Let's see. I have a lot of them. I go out, but I'll give a shout out to this kind of nice fusion sushi place in Little Italy called Cloak and Petal. I like that a lot.
Very cool. Do you drink coffee? And if so, how do you take it?
I do. I'm currently drinking in front of me on my desk a salted cold foam cold brew from Starbucks.
There you go. Is a hot dog a sandwich?
Huh, I'd never thought about that. I'm going to go with no.
All right. And last one for you. Is brunch overrated?
Yes.
All right. Very good. I like that answer. Rick, any questions for me today?
No, I appreciate all your time. I think it's been a great conversation, and I hope people enjoy it.
Cool. We will have contact info in the episode description if they want to reach out to you verbally. Rick, what's the best way for people to get a hold of either you, the company, whatever it might be?
To get a hold of Miva, it's www.miva.com. To get a hold of me, the best way is email rwilson, R-W-I-L-S-O-N, at miva.com.
Very cool. And dragonproofbook.com, just to plug that for you one more time as well, if you're interested in checking that out. Rick Wilson, everyone, CEO at Miva, author of Dragonproof E-Commerce, and host of Protecting Your Online Business podcast. Rick, thanks for your time today. To those listening, especially our listener of the week, Mary from DC. If you want to be the listener of the week, let me know you've tuned in. And if you're interested in telling your marketing story, I'd love to hear from you as well. Until next time, have a great day and be kind to one another.